This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. Police fired tear gas inside a train station Sunday and in several other Hong Kong neighborhoods where protesters occupied roads in another weekend of anti-government demonstrations. Protesters hurled bricks at officers and ignored warnings to leave before tear gas was deployed. Nearby, protesters wearing gas masks gathered outside a police station as officers wearing their own protective gear looked down at them from a tall wall around the station. Earlier, a large group of mostly young protesters marched down the middle of Hennessy Road, a main shopping drag in the Causeway Bay area, as a rally was held in nearby Victoria Park. Muslim worshippers and Israeli police have clashed at a major Jerusalem holy site during prayers marking the Islamic holiday of Eid al-Adha. Reuters' Emmer McCarthy reports.
Palestinians clashed with Israeli police on Sunday outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, where tens of thousands of Muslim worshippers were gathered for the Eid al-Adha holiday. Police fired sound grenades and there were scuffles in the packed compound outside the site, which is revered by Muslims and Jews and is one of the most sensitive sites in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Tensions have mounted at the Flashpoint complex as Eid al-Adha this year overlaps with the Jewish fast day of Tisha B'Av. Police initially barred the entry of non-Muslim visitors in an effort to avoid friction at the mosque before clashes erupted.
That is Reuters' Emmer McCarthy reporting. The Saudi-led coalition launched a strike against Yemen's port city of Aden Sunday to support the government after a Houthi attack. The Western-backed coalition said it attacked an area that was a direct threat to the Saudi-based government. This is VOA News. Jeffrey Epstein's apparent suicide leaves his victims feeling cheated and demanding answers. AP's Tim McGuire has more.
Billionaire Jeffrey Epstein's death while in federal custody in New York stuns his accusers, but they vow to press on. Attorney Spencer Kuvin represents one of the women. He tells Sky News.
She was shocked, obviously, that something like this could occur under the Federal Bureau of Prisons watch.
Kuvin adding.
We find it very hard to believe that he would be allowed to commit suicide, especially when he was on suicide watch from just a few days ago.
Epstein was accused of orchestrating a sex trafficking ring for years and sexually abusing dozens of underage girls. Attorney General William Barr says he was appalled and is demanding an investigation by the FBI and the Justice Department's Inspector General's office. I'm Tim McGuire.
Police in Tanzania say at least 62 people have been burned to death and more than 70 others are being treated for burns after a fuel tanker explosion in the eastern town of Morogoro. Officials say people were trying to siphon off fuel from the damaged tanker Saturday when the blast happened. Witnesses said the tanker had been involved in an accident. As events marking the 70th anniversary of the 1949 Geneva Conventions get underway, the International Committee of the Red Cross says these four landmark treaties delineating the law of war are as relevant today as they were when they came into force August 12, 1949. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The 1949 Geneva Conventions grew out of the horrors of World War II. It took only 4 months for the four treaties, which are universally ratified, to come into force. The treaties contain the core elements of the international humanitarian law, the law of war, which aims to reduce suffering in armed conflict. ICRC Director of International Law and Policy, Helen Durham, recognizes the law of war is not always followed, but she notes when they work, they have an impact. Durham says an area of major concern for the ICRC is the treatment of detainees. She says clear rules governing the care of prisoners of war are laid out in the conventions. However, these frequently are not enforced in the context of civil wars where non-state actors are involved. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
At least five people were killed and several injured after a rocket explosion on an Arctic naval test range in Russia. Authorities in Sverdlovsk, 46 kilometers away, reported a rise in radiation levels and people were panic purchasing iodine drops. For all the latest news, when you're on the go, download the VOA mobile app or go to voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I know that the special envoy was in Juba during the week, and he met with the stakeholders and also with the leadership of the SPLM-IO. I am certain that the SPLM-IO made his position very clear to him that we are for the full implementation of the peace agreement.
The Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition calls on the special Kenyan envoy to help expedite the full implementation of the security arrangement.
Yes, it's a very restrictive regulation, as if I can state that freedom of expression is an essential right. And it is the cornerstone of any democratic society, which I believe Uganda is, because we have ascribed to all these national, regional, and international freedom of expression laws.
Ugandan social media users express concern a regulation will restrict freedom of expression.
We have seven core team members who have arrived in Tunis and are now working. One who's looking at the legal part of the election, one who looks at gender issues, one who's our security person. We have a political analyst who looks at the political side of issues.
And the Carter Center deploys poll observers to monitor Tunisians' upcoming presidential and parliamentary elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A spokesperson for the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in Opposition, or SPLM-IO, has called on the special Kenyan envoy to South Sudan to help expedite the full implementation of the security arrangement. Manasseh Zindo says the failure to realize the deal could hamper the creation of the unity government enshrined in the revitalized agreement. His remarks follow the recent meeting between Kalonzo Musyoka, the special Kenyan envoy to South Sudan, with all stakeholders of the accord. For more reaction, I reach Manasseh Zindo, the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth, Empowerment and Sports.
I know that the special envoy was in Juba during the week, and he met with the stakeholders and also with the leadership of the SPLM-IO. I am certain that the SPLM-IO made its position very clear to him that we are for the full implementation of the peace agreement. And the key in the implementation of the agreement is the security arrangement. So at the moment, as we talk with you, all the forces have been ordered to move to the cantonment centers in the case of the opposition forces, and the government forces to move to the barracks. Now, in the cantonment center and in the barracks, there will be screening. There will be a process of us coming up with the one unified force. So one unified national army is really what South Sudan needs at the moment. So when the special envoy said there should be no further delay, I really don't know what he was referring to, because in May, we agreed that we will extend the pre-transitional period by 6 months until November, so that we could implement these important provisions like the one I've told you about.
But there are strong concerns by the body monitoring the ceasefire that there seem to be a slow progress in the implementation of the security arrangement in the revitalized peace agreement. So that is the major concern. Why do you think they have such a concern?
Yes, the slow process. And the slow process is mainly because our partners, the people who supported us to sign the agreement, did not come forward to support the process of the security arrangement. So it was left to the parties, and the parties have been struggling to do the security arrangement. So really, I would love very much if the special envoy could use his influence and the goodwill that he enjoys among the South Sudanese leaders to speed up the security arrangement. It is what is delaying, it is what is taking us slow. If we can speed up the security arrangement, then there would be no concern. We would be set for the formation of the new government come November 12th.
Do you think there is political commitment from both sides to ensure the formation of this unity government in November?
I can speak on the side of the SPLM-IO that there is a strong political will and a commitment. At the moment, Dr. Riek Machar, our leader, has spent about 2 to 3 weeks in Addis Ababa, meeting with envoys and with partners to plead with them so that they could support up the process. I want to believe that it is the same on the government side because the president always speaks and reaffirming his commitment. I want to believe that it is the same case on the government side, and probably what could be lacking is the technicalities of implementing the security arrangement, mainly the funds, because we need money, we need the resources to put in the containment centers, we need the shelters, we need the water in those areas. In fact, I want to seize this opportunity, to call on the partners. They know themselves, those ones who are committed, to put up shelters, those who are committed themselves to dig boreholes in the containment centers, please let them do it so that it can speed up this process and we form a new government come November.
What are the assurances that both parties agreed to meet in order for South Sudanese to have confidence that they will have a unity government and that there will be peace in this transitional period before the next general election?
After a very serious fight like the one we've had in South Sudan, confidence building is very, very important. And the message that comes from leaders, their actions is also very important. It is what gives the civil population the assurance that you are talking about. So far, those of us who are in the different mechanisms that were set up to speed up the implementation of the agreement, we are doing our work. We talk to each other. And I think what really the South Sudanese people would want to see is that let the principles be met often. And at times, if the principles meet often, they could agree on these things and it could work out very quickly. There's been a call for the principles to meet. And we are really waiting. We hope the principles could meet more often to give the kind of assurance you are asking about.
Manasseh Zindo is the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sport. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The executive director for the Ugandan Freedom of Expression Media Hub says a newly announced regulation to monitor individuals with large followings would violate constitutional right of freedom of speech. Catherine Aniti says she would like to see the regulation challenged in court. Officials say the rule would enable the Ugandan Communication Commission, the state regulator, to clamp down on immoral or prejudiced content. The regulation requires users to register and pay a fee of $20. For more reaction to the new rule, I reach Catherine Aniti, Executive Director of the Freedom of Expression Media Hub.
For me, it's not shocking because when you look at the regional context, it started with Tanzania. We saw Tanzania enacting the electronic and postal communications online content regulations, which came into effect in March of 2018. And when you look at UCC's notice for online content providers to register with it, it was a March 2018 call. So I wouldn't say that what happened a few days ago is something new. UCC had already given out that notice, and maybe it wasn't taken that seriously. So I'm not sure what has triggered them to come up again with this.
Do you think the regulation by the Uganda Communication Commission infringes on the rights of freedom of expression as guaranteed by the Ugandan Constitution?
Yes, it's a very restrictive regulation, as if I can state that freedom of expression is an essential right. And it is the cornerstone of any democratic society, which I believe Uganda is, because we have ascribed to all these national, regional, and international freedom of expression laws. When you look at our Article 29 of the Constitution, it says that every person shall have the right to freedom of expression and speech, and that includes the press. There should be restrictions. However, public interest shall not permit any limitations of everyone to enjoy their rights beyond what is acceptable in a democratic society and what's demonstrably justifiable in a free society. So Uganda is a free society. Uganda is a democratic society. So if the Constitution gives the right to enjoy freedom of expression, there shouldn't be the clawback clauses that come in form of policies and other restrictive laws.
I understand that, Catherine, but there is also a responsibility associated with the freedom of expression. For example, you can't go into a movie theater and shout fire because that could create problem. And that supporters of the government say is the reason why this thing has to be enforced, because some Ugandans are using this, as President Museveni says, to spread lies and gossip, basically fake news.
Well, I should say that freedom of expression should be restricted within what we call the three-part test. So one, it must be provided by law. The question is this notice a law? And when we say provided for by law, the restrictions or limitations to be permissible, the law must be very clear and in a precise manner. What we are seeing is just an announcement. So who enacted it? Is it the minister? Was there a board meeting at Uganda Communications Commission saying, you know, there's a mischief here which we need to resolve, so we're going to ask the minister to come up with regulations since he has the power to enact them? We don't know if it's just a pronouncement, if we've not seen the regulations as per se, to kind of say that they are they have any legal backing. They're unclear for now, and I can't say that they are real. Well, it's a real threat that they have already announced, but we need to see the announcement put in form of a regulation, in form of legal backing. Secondly, is that restriction, does it serve a legitimate purpose? Why are they coming up now to say all social media or influencers must pay $20, and yet they're already taxing social media?
There's a school of thought that this new regulation should be challenged in court. What is your stance?
Yes, I think it should be challenged because it doesn't meet the basic requirements of restricting freedom of expression. Maybe we are yet to see the Minister of ICT coming up with regulations like Tanzania did last year, you know, to charge bloggers and all content providers. But for now, I think it's too early for us to say that this is law until we see that the UCC has actually put out that legal document or the regulations with a clear pathway of how people are going to register, how people are going to pay, where that money is going, who is going to be in charge of that money, what it's going to do. It has to be very clear.
Catherine Anite is the executive director of the Freedom of Expression Media Hub. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The Carter Center has deployed poll observers to monitor Tunisia's presidential and parliamentary elections. The North African country goes to the polls on September 15 for the presidential vote and October 16 for the legislative election. Officials say the observers will monitor the pre-electoral environment, among others. For more about the Carter Center mission, I reach the mission director, Donald Bizon, in the Tunisian capital, Tunis.
We have seven core team members who have arrived in Tunis and are now working. One who's working at the legal part of the election, one who looks at gender issues, one who's our security person. We have a political analyst who looks at the political side of issues, and then I am the mission director. We have 16 long-term observers who have been deployed throughout the country in 8 different locations, and they were deployed on July 22nd, and they will stay until after the last round of the presidential election. And they look at the regional issues, and they follow the campaign. Right now, they're following candidate nominations for the presidential, which is taking place this week, and they follow the candidate nominations for the parliament elections, which happened 2 weeks ago. And then they will monitor and observe the campaign period, the actual campaign. On election day, we'll bring in an additional 45 short-term observers who will be trained here in Tunis, and then we'll deploy them throughout the country to observe the electoral procedures on Election Day, and then on the September 17th, 2 days after the election, we will have a press conference where we release a preliminary statement.
Apart from the benchmarks that you will be looking at, particularly with this election process, what is the coordination with the local electoral commission as to its work and your meetings with them?
Yes, and we have a very good relationship with, it's called the ISIE here, the ISIE, which is the High Independent Authority for Elections. They're the body that actually invited us to come and observe these elections. We meet with them on a regular basis on the working level. Our electoral analyst goes over there every week actually to talk to them about how the process is going, any issues they have. We look at whether they're following the election law. We look at any kind of technical issues they have. And our LTOs liaise with their regional offices. They have 27 regional offices, one in each of the electoral constituencies. And we meet with them also on a regular basis to observe how things are going and to see whether or not they're meeting the standards and commitments and also domestic law.
How about the issue of security? Because some people have expressed concern about voter security and that prospective voters will be protected during the electoral process.
Yes, we monitor the security situation. We have a security expert who's here on the mission with us full time. We liaise with all of the embassies who have security people in the country. We liaise with the ISSE, which has a election security committee, which deals with election day security. We liaise also with the Minister of Interior, who's in charge of setting up security for Election Day. Obviously, there are security concerns here with the incidents that happened in 2015 and recently in the last couple of months. On Election Day, we are not expecting any major security issues. We know that there'll be police stationed at every polling station. In 2014, I was also here for the elections then as part of the Carter Center Observation Mission. There were at least two police officers at every polling station. And Election Day in 2014 and in 2018 for the local elections passed without any kind of security incident. Obviously, the build-up to the election security is increased in the country. There's still a state of emergency that was declared in 2015 has been ongoing, and they just extended it again. I assume it'll be extended until after the election period is over in order to ensure security for the campaign and for the election day itself.
Don, with your experience of monitoring elections in Tunisia, what will your expectations be in the upcoming elections? And if I may ask, will you also be monitoring the behavior of prospective voters as well as the contribution of the political parties in ensuring transparency and credibility in the electoral process?
Yeah, we monitor particularly the political parties and the candidates, and for the legislative election, the parties, the independent candidates and the party candidates. We monitor their compliance with the domestic law as far as campaign violations, campaign finance violations, whether or not they're using hate speech or using divisive language, which is outlawed in this country during the campaign period. We don't particularly monitor the behavior of the voters except for the extent that we monitor on election day what's happening at the polling station, what the atmosphere is, how people are feeling about voting on election day. But we do monitor the situation and the atmosphere as a whole, as we call the campaign environment, that happens within the country during the campaign period and then immediately after the campaign.
Donald Bizon is the mission director for the Carter Center Poll Observer Mission. He spoke with me from Tunis. Public sector workers in the Kingdom of Eswatini are planning to strike for better living conditions. The action, which has been scheduled for September 16, follows a dispute with the government over a pay increase to cover the sharp rise in the cost of living. The government had petitioned an industrial court to prevent the workers from embarking on the strike.
However, the court ruled that the workers' demand for better working conditions is not illegal. To learn more about the plans for the strike action, I reached Thulani Klachwayu, Secretary General for the Eswatini Public Servants and Allied Workers Union.
It has taken a long time. It is about the COLA, which is the cost of living adjustment. So we had done all the processes after we deadlocked on the cost of living adjustment. And then we were planning to go to strike on the 24th of September last year, which is 2018. And on the 20th of September, government went to court to impact it, claiming that the strike will have a great impact and innocent citizens will suffer in the form that the health department will also be on strike. A judgment on that case was received just a week ago on the 29th of August 2019. And then the public service associations met to discuss on the way forward after the judgment, after the court had said we must reintroduce notices to strike.
If the government denies your plans to go on strike as you have scheduled on September 16, what are the contingency measures for your group?
We don't expect them to go back to court and stop this one again, because a judgment has been given by the court that we must reintroduce or resubmit notices to strike. And yes, it can happen that a government can rush back to court, because they always come on the eve of the strike and then pronounce that the strike is illegal. Unfortunately, we have never met such a situation where it has gone back to court and agreed that it will go to strike and government opposes again. But in the event such happens, we will be forced not to consider that court ruling. And we are mobilizing as of now. But if they can also do like they have done before, rushing to the media, because us, the union, are barred from both types of the media, be it electronic. We are only sending messages just by placards around the major town. So during our mobilization, the build-up to the strike, we will be telling our members that whatever happens, even if they can announce over the radio, the strike will continue.
The government said it cannot afford any pay increases, and you are going on strike to pressure the government to improve the standard of living or some pay increment. This is a pure stalemate before you even begin. How do you resolve the stalemate?
This one is for COLA 2017-2018. What we have done through our legal representatives, they have given government that government, you say you do not have money, but you can owe us. We can settle for 4%, and then you will owe us the 3.8%. But government does not want to agree that the COLA for 2017 is 7.8%. We have split this one to 4%, and then government will owe us 3.8%. Whenever he has the money to pay, he will pay the balance for 3.8%.
You are aware that the government has said it doesn't have the money to pay. It has not agreed to pay the arrangement that you are making. So what impact do you think this upcoming strike will have on resolving this payment demand that you're making on the government?
It is only about the government to acknowledge that they are owing COLA for 2017. But she, government, does not even want to acknowledge the fact that they are owing COLA 2017. And they are saying, in the event that the government is stable, the economy is stable, they will address the issues of COLA. And what will happen to the past 3 years when we were not receiving COLA? That is what we are fighting for. That acknowledge that you owe us. And the moment the finances are stable, you will pay back what you owe. Because even the taxes, as you can tell, we haven't been getting a salary adjustment for the past 3 years. Even ourselves, our living is very difficult. We cannot now afford a lot of things that we used to afford in 2016. So government cannot say, I'll be having money 2020 and we will address COLA. We are saying, acknowledge the fact that you are owing us pull up from behind. Even if they can say today, hey, comrades, we cannot offer you this 7.8%, but we will offer it the moment the finances are stable. That is all we are calling for. For government to acknowledge that they are owing us, COLA, for the past 3 years.
Thulani Hlatshwayo is the Secretary General for the Eswatini Public Servants and Allied Workers Union. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sport with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, as events marking the 70th anniversary of the 1949 Geneva Conventions get underway, the International Committee of the Red Cross says these four landmark treaties delineating the law of war are as relevant today as they were when they came into force August 12, 1949. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The 1949 Geneva Conventions grew out of the horrors of World War II. It took only 4 months for the four treaties, which are universally ratified, to come into force. The treaties contain the core elements of the international humanitarian law, the law of war, which aims to reduce suffering in armed conflict. The law requires all parties to a conflict to abide by provisions that include a prohibition against torture, appropriate treatment of civilians, caring for the wounded on the battlefield, and the dignified treatment of the remains of the dead. ICRC Director of International Law and Policy, Helen Durham, recognizes the law of war is not always followed, but she notes when they work, they have an impact. She says ICRC delegates in the field see these laws in action every day.
We see, for example, the capacity for us to get fresh water to 6 million Syrians. This is the law of war in action. We see every time a wounded combatant passes a checkpoint to get access to medical assistance, it's the laws of war in action.
At the same time, Durham acknowledges the many challenges to the conventions posed by new technologies. She says issues such as cyber warfare, artificial intelligence, autonomous weapons, and the changing nature of conflict present new threats. When the conventions were crafted 70 years ago, she says international wars among belligerent states dominated. Now most wars are internal civil conflicts. She tells VOA, as far back as the 1970s, a survey found a dramatic increase in civilian casualties as a consequence of this change.
In World War I, I think the statistics are 1 out of 9 people killed was a civilian. In World War II, it was around 50-50. And then when we looked at the Vietnam and other wars of decolonization, the statistics inversed, where up to 90% of casualties during conflict were civilians. To date, that continues. So civilians are very often the major casualties.
Durham says an area of major concern for the ICRC is the treatment of detainees. She says clear rules governing the care of prisoners of war are laid out in the conventions. However, these frequently are not enforced in the context of civil wars where non-state actors are involved. She says this is one area where international law must evolve to make the laws of war more relevant to present-day existing reality. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Zimbabwe celebrates Heroes Day on Monday, a day earmarked to celebrate those who fought in the liberation struggle against oppressive white minority rule. For VOA, Kutsaye's Vanavashi has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The liberation struggle was largely fought by native Zimbabweans fighting against white minority rule. They sought to create a society where everyone's freedoms and human rights were respected. Early this week, Minister of Information Monica Mutswangwa announced the theme for the holiday.
This year's Heroes Day celebrations will be held under the theme Lest We Forget. The theme of the Heroes Day celebrations serves as a reminder to the whole nation on the need to reflect on the supreme sacrifices of our gallant heroes and heroines who brought about the freedom and independence we enjoy today.
Grace Chirenje is a feminist. She says she welcomes the Heroes Day, but with reservations.
I think the lest we forget is quite ironic, because we seem to have forgotten the reason why they went to war. The reason they went to war was that I could enjoy my basic human rights as a citizen of Zimbabwe. That legacy has been taken away from us. So our basic human rights are not being respected, even access to basic commodities.
Activist Charles Nyoni says, while he recognizes and appreciates sacrifices made in the liberation struggle, he will not be celebrating Heroes Day.
Celebrating heroes, for me, it's shallow in the sense that I'm a born free. Up to now, I haven't enjoyed the benefits that they went to actually fight for. For me, to celebrate heroes, it's a sheer waste of my time because I am not yet free.
Nyoni blames the new elite system that replaced the colonial minority rule. For many like Nyoni, Heroes Day will just be another day Zimbabweans stay home and take a break. Chirenje says, while we celebrate living and fallen heroes, we should take time to celebrate the modern ones as well. That's every Zimbabwean who has kept hope alive and has been pushing towards the development of the country. For VOA, this is Kudze Zinawashe from Harare.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, Somalia football has returned to African Continental Club competition for the first time in 29 years. The Somali Football Federation has entered two clubs into Continental Club competition since 1990. Mogadishu City Club compete in the Confederation Cup against Zanzibar's Malindi in the first round, the first leg match. They were drawn at home in the first leg, but cannot play in Somalia because of security problems. They have opted to play both legs in Zanzibar in order to cut costs. Somali champions, the Kadaha, take on Egypt's Zamalek in the African Champions League, but the opening game of that tie will be on August 16th. They also play both legs of their tie at the home of their opponents. The last Somali club to participate in the old-style Champions Cup was MBC and was eliminated in the first round by St. Louis of Seychelles in 1990. Meanwhile, Nigeria is bidding to host the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup. If their bid is successful, Nigeria will become the first African country to host a FIFA Women's Tournament. A FIFA inspection team has inspected facilities across the country in the proposed cities of Lagos, Benin City, Asaba, and Uyo. The inspection team is expected to make a final decision later in the year. Nigeria have previously hosted the Men's Under-20 World Cup in 1999 and the Under-27 version 10 years later. Nigeria are one of four countries, alongside USA, Germany, and Brazil, to have participated in every World Under-20 tournament since its inception 17 years ago. The Falcons reached the final in 2010 and 2014, but lost to Germany on both occasions. And in tennis, Serena Williams beat qualifier Marie Bazokova to set up a Rogers Cup final against Canadian teenager Bianca Andreescu. Bazokova lost 1-6, 6-3, 6-3 to 23-time Grand Slam champion Williams. Andreescu beat American Sofia Kenin 6-4, 7-6, 7-5 in the other semi-final and is the first Canadian woman to reach the final of the tournament since 1969. Meanwhile, Rafael Nadal reached the final without playing a shot after Gael Monfils withdrew from the semi-final with ankle injury. Monfils had beaten Roberto Bautista Agut 6-4, 6-3, 7-6, 7-2 in the quarterfinal. Nadal will play Russia's Daniil Medvedev in Sunday's final. And in boxing, Britain's Anthony Joshua will face unified world heavyweight champion Andre Ruiz Jr. in their rematch in Saudi Arabia on December 7th. The two fought New York in June, with Ruiz earning a shock 7-round stoppage victory to hand Joshua his first professional loss. Ruiz, who was knocked down in the third round before recovering, picked up the WBA, IBF, WBO and IBO titles. However, Saudi choice has been questioned over the country's abysmal human rights record. Meanwhile, Vasyl Lomachenko will fight Luke Campbell for the WBA, Super, WBC and WBO world titles in London's O2 Arena on August 31st. Finally, in athletics, it's been confirmed that defending champion Mary Kaitane of Kenya and Ethiopia's Lelisa Desisa will return to New York City Marathon race on November 3rd. Kaitane will go for her fifth career title in New York, and Desisa will be gunning for a second. Last year, Kaitane became the second woman to win in New York City in the open division four times, recording the second fastest time in the event's history in 2 hours, 22 minutes, and 48 seconds. She's the women's only marathon world record holder at 2:17.01 and a two-time winner of the Abbott World Marathon Majors. Desisa won his first New York title last year after finishing on the podium three times previously. He held off fellow Ethiopian Shura Kitata by 2 seconds to finish in 2 hours, 5 minutes and 59 seconds. That was the second fastest time in event history. Desisa also has two Boston Marathon titles, having won there in 2013 and 2015. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you're hearing from Ben Paul featuring Tamaya with Sana. Simi comes next with Jerumi. Singer follows with Tayamo. Then we end with Yemi Alade featuring Soti Soul with Africa.
For you, girl, forever, me a there. Me don't send anybody, me a there. Oh, forever, girl, me a there. Passing me break it go go. In any kosha me go go. Now leave your show now, mzigo. I will never let you go. Emeritika sana, unachonipa sana, nimefika sana. Sina mwingine nimeridhika sana, unachonipa sana, nimefika sana. Sina mwingine. Girl, I wanna go another day. Can you make my body go 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 go? I wanna go another day. Hey yeah, hey. I wanna go another day. Can you make my body go 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 go? Girl, I wanna go another day. Hata wakikupinga, umefuzu kwangu nimesha kupenda. Haujui tu ya nini takulinda. Uoga wa mapenzi umefunzwa. Oh honey, honey, love sijiringa. Oh baby, oh mi nimesha kupenda. Oh no, 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 usije kunitenda. Uoga wa mapenzi umefunzwa. Hey, basi nipe kidogo. Inanikosha mikoko. Na ulivyo shona mzigo. I'll never let you go, go. Umenifunga kipago. Na kwako bado nipogo. Usije nipaki soko. I'll never let you go. Nimeridhika sana, unachonipa sana, nimefika sana, sina mwingine. Nimeridhika sana, unachonipa sana, nimefika sana, sina mwingine. We'll be right back.
So for me, you talk say it like me. I be rolling pagon. Kilo de joro, I dey give you signal. She you know they see me. I give you green light, fire. Joro mi joro, I'm walking on bubble. Oh, come my love from bubble. I go shoot my shot to you.
Mamacita, te amo. Love the way that you are always for me. Señorita, te amo. Love the way that I put it on the for me. Puede que seas mi amiga. Girl, you know that I love you. Oh, oh, oh. Anything that you want me to, girl, I go do for you. Because when I tell it, I know I go give you the love and show you one more. If the money you want, baby, got it all. Love me, touch me, kiss me, baby, don't go, don't go. Te amo. Girl, you know I could die for you. Angelina, te amo. I feel kill any bagger for you. Baby, please don't go. Puede que seas mi amiga. Girl, I just won't be a friend. Y yapo mina kupenda. Baby, please don't leave me.
That was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The justice minister of the Gambia was severely criticized last week when he announced that three former policemen who were part of the hit squad of former President Jammeh, now in exile in Equatorial Guinea, should be released from prison on the grounds that they had provided very important information to the people of the Gambia, which would not otherwise have been available unless they had given the various information in their testimony. This announcement was received very, very poorly in the Gambia. Many Gambians felt that men who had participated in the murder of a popular journalist or any individual should not be allowed to walk the streets of the Gambia. But the justice minister tried to explain that the nature of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions was exactly what he was doing, that these commissions were set up to get the records straight, and that those who have spoken frankly and honestly about deeds in of the past should be allowed to go free. In fact, some of us who were participants in the negotiations in South Africa that preceded the end of apartheid and understood why the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa was agreed to are always baffled by the swift embrace by many African countries of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa. They did not understand the specific essence and concrete situation of South Africa that led to the TRC in South Africa. So this is what exactly the Justice Minister was trying to explain. For those who may not know it, it was not an easy decision for the South African negotiators to make. Many have thought that those in the apartheid regime should be punished severely for the horrific crimes they committed during the apartheid period. However, the apartheid officials were also pointing fingers as to what they considered crimes committed by the ANC and the PAC during the struggle against the apartheid period. So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was an attempt to resolve a troublesome issue. And when the commission met, the chairman was Bishop Tutu, and he ably chaired that commission, and it became worldwide popular for the way it was handled, preventing bloodshed in South Africa at the end of apartheid in 1994. Those in Africa who embraced it did not understand that history in South Africa. But even in South Africa, there were many South Africans who were not pleased with the outcome of the Truth and Truth Commission because they felt that those in the apartheid regime should be punished. And there was a time when even former President Mbeki, when the report was concluded, refused to accept it, arguing that it was not right to compare crimes of the apartheid period with any kind of human rights violation that may have occurred in the ANC and PAC camps outside of South Africa. But the great Mandela intervened to say that they should allow it to go forward. There was only one particular case that troubled many South Africans, that of Mr. Eugene D. Kok, who really revealed horrific crimes under the apartheid period. And even times when he himself, as a colonel in the police force, tried to engineer a race war in South Africa to prevent the end of apartheid. So he, along with two other white apartheid officials, were the only ones who were persecuted. And but even he too, after 20 years in prison, and now is a free man in South Africa. The lesson which I think the Minister of Justice of the Gambia was trying to put forward, one must learn the background to things before you embrace them. I thank you.
That was Mwamman's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Kwame Ufori, and our engineer for today, Xiaogang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, quality beats do not rattle. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.